We are starting to prepare for this Holy Day season that is fast approaching. Just a little over 3 weeks, we will be here observing the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. And so with that, of course, we have this very interesting command and this very interesting custom that we call de-leavening. Now, when you think about de-leavening, it's really kind of a strange practice. If you've ever had to describe this to anyone else who's never de-leavened, they probably look at you a little funny because it's a really odd thing to do. So you're telling me you're going to take your baking powder and your baking soda and your crackers and bread. You're going to take all of this stuff and throw it away. Yes, that's what I'm going to do. All right. Well, can't you just, you know, put it outside and then bring it back in later? No, I'm not going to do that. All right. Well, so you're going to get rid of all your mixes and all your stuff here and there? Yes. And then you might tell them, yeah, and, you know, I'm going to clean out my oven, I'm going to clean out my cupboards, and I'll probably, you know, vacuum out my car. Your car? Well, yeah, I'm going to vacuum out my car. All right. Well, that's interesting. And that's usually where the conversation ends. I've rarely gotten past that point in a conversation with anyone because it's strange. It's a little weird, right? There's nothing quite like it. Even in all of God's other commands, there's really nothing quite like it. You think about the other preparations, the other things we do to prepare for or during other holy days, and there's nothing quite like the concept of de-leavening, of putting leaven out. But it is a commanded practice. Let's take a look. Because he reiterates this to us multiple times. Let's go over to Exodus 12. Exodus 12, and verse 15. God commanding, giving them commandments about the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, this holy day season, says, "For 7 days you are to eat bread made without yeast. On the first day, remove the yeast from your houses, for whoever eats anything with yeast in it from the first day through the seventh day must be cut off from Israel." Okay, so we're told that we're going to put this out on the first day. It means by the first day. It doesn't actually mean on the first day, because during that first day of the feast, we know we are to be de-leavened. The translation here would better be by the first day. Remove the yeast from your houses. Drop down to verse 19. "For 7 days, no yeast is to be found in your houses." Again, sort of reiterating the point that this is by the first day. So for those 7 days, no yeast is to be found in your houses, in your dwellings. "And anyone, whether foreigner or native born, who eats anything with yeast in it must be cut off from the community of Israel." So we're told we're putting all of this yeast and this leavening stuff out. And then for 7 days, we're not going to consume anything that has it in it. It's not that you take the yeast and you put it out, and then you can, you know, go out and buy some more to replace it during the week. No, you put it out and you leave it out for 7 days. Let's go over to Deuteronomy 16. It's retold. Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy is a retelling in a sense. It's a re-giving of the law. So we have Deuteronomy 16, verse 4, tells us this: "And there shall be no leavened bread seen with you in all your borders for 7 days. So the idea being, when they go into the land and they have their territory and their country, that they would get rid of their leavened bread, perhaps even destroy it, and that within their borders for 7 days, nobody's making leavened bread. There's no leavened bread available. It shouldn't be present. And so we do this today. We take leavening agents and we put them out of our houses, and then for 7 days we don't consume anything. It can be a lot of work. It can be a lot of prep. You can spend a lot of time on this. And you can start to ask yourself sometimes, what's the point? Right? Why am I doing this? How much effort do I really need to put into this? Is it that important? Is it that big of a deal? To really understand that, to understand whether it's important or not, why we should, shouldn't do it, how much we should or shouldn't be investing in it, we need to look at the background. We need to understand the story. We need to understand the command and why it was given. We're going to look at some symbology in Exodus. We're going to look at types in Exodus. There are two types that we're going to look at specifically. I'm not going to give extensive proofs because this is an overview of sort of generally understood symbols. If you really want to dig in and prove these things, there are many, many scriptures to do that. We don't have the time today to go through all of them, although it is very fascinating. We have a lot of literature on the church's website about these ideas and these concepts. But there are two major types or symbols of sin in Exodus, in the book of Exodus. One of them is leavening, right? Which is why we're told to take leavening and put it out. It's a type of sin, and we'll see more of that as we go through today, the Exodus account. But leavening represents sin, and there's a reason for that. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6. First Corinthians 5 and verse 6 says, your boasting is not good. Don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Get rid of the old leaven so that you may be a new lump as you really are. For Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with the old bread leavened with malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Here, presumably, as they're leading up to this festival, Paul's encouraging them. Here's what we do. Here's our account. Here's how we keep this holy day. And also, here's the type. Here's the symbology. He says, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. His point is, sin spreads. He was talking to them about sin there in the congregation and saying, this, you can't have this among you. And his point is, you can't have this here because this will spread. That's what sin does. He's not telling them just to, you know, we just want to put most of it out and you can leave this little batch sort of in the back of the cupboard. Because the type, right, the type being sin, well, the type of that leaven is representing, it's representing sin, which will spread. Sin spreads. That's the whole point of what he's saying here. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. You can't have a little bit. You can't tuck a little bit away here, have a little bit stored over there, because it will grow. It doesn't stagnate. It doesn't stay isolated. Sin is a dynamic thing that changes, and it will just get worse. So that's one type. Leavening there represents sin in the book of Exodus. The other type of sin is Egypt. Egypt itself represents sin. There's a reason for that also. If you go over to Exodus 1, and verse 8, it says, a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous and, if war breaks out, will join our enemies and fight against us and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. He's saying, God is telling us, sin will enslave you. Egypt is a type of sin, right? And if you're there in it, it's going to enslave you. It's going to oppress you. And it's going to do so ruthlessly. It's a very harsh taskmaster. We see this confirmed over in the book of John. Jesus Christ himself confirms this idea. Let's go over to John 8. Very simple. Words of Jesus Christ. He says, "Very truly I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin." So we have this type there in Exodus of Egypt representing bondage, representing slavery. Both types are very important. Both types are related to our preparation, our de-leavening. So you might say, okay, that's interesting. So leavening represents sin. I need to put sin out. I got it. I'll go get rid of it. Done. Good. Problem is, if we stop there, if we just say, okay, I got my leavening in the trash. It's gone out. Good to go. Clean the house. Everything's fine. If we just stop there, we sort of miss the intent. We're going to miss the intent of what God's actually commanding us to do. He's commanding us to do more than just take a few physical items off of our shelves, maybe wipe some things down, vacuum some things out, and be done. He wants more than that. He wants more than just going through these physical motions of taking stuff and dumping it. We can see this because we can take a look at the amount of preparation that God himself put into this day, this season, these holy days. Let's go back and look at the account in Exodus. From that perspective, let's go to Exodus 2. Think about all of the preparation that God put in leading up to the actual Passover and the days of unleavened bread. You think about everything that God had to do for ancient Israel. You think about everything God had to do for us. There's a significant amount of preparation, right, that had to go into all of this. And he's asking us to sort of join him in that. He wants us to do some preparation right alongside there. We start to understand something about this holy day by doing a little some sort of preparation beforehand, is what it's starting to look like. We can see God's plans and God's preparation. The end of Exodus 2 in verse 23. "Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them." So you get the sense here, God sees what's happening, and he's starting to put his plan in motion. He probably already had his plan. He already knew exactly what was going to work out. But it tells us explicitly, God was listening. He heard their cries. And here at this moment, he starts to put this plan in motion that he's been preparing for. And he's going to continue to prepare for. Let's turn over to chapter 3. Verse 7. He's talking to Moses. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. God understands the oppression of slavery. He understands the oppression of sin. He knows what it does to us, even before we could even know to cry out about it. He understands it. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Let's drop down to verse 19. He tells Moses, I'm sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not even by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in its midst. And after that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be when you go that you shall not go empty handed. But every woman shall ask her neighbor, namely of her who dwells near her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and your daughters. So shall you plunder the Egyptians. God had already planned in so much detail what was going to happen here. We can see a whole set of things, a whole set of details that God already knew. He already knew Moses was going to lead his people out. He knew Pharaoh's not going to let them go. He knew, we see from earlier passages, he knew Moses was going to need proofs of his authority, both to the Pharaoh and to the Israelites. God knew he would need to work many wonders because Pharaoh would resist. He knew that the Israelites, details down to the fact that the Israelites would actually increase in favor with the Egyptians, which boggles my mind a little bit, that here it is that here's this Hebrew God that they recognize as the Hebrew God doing all of this to their land, and they actually increase in favor. And Moses increases in respect among the Egyptians to the point that God knew that they would plunder the Egyptians, and the Egyptians would willingly give them things on their way out. God knew he would bring them to Sinai. We see him tell Moses earlier in the chapter that, I will bring you back to this mountain. And he tells him, I know where I'm taking them. I'm taking them to Canaan. So God had a plan. He had this whole thing laid out. He had already prepared a whole set of events that he knew he was going to have to follow through on and bring about. Let's keep going a little bit further in the account. An interesting side note here. Exodus 5 and verse 4. A side note, thinking about sin and thinking about Egypt as that type of sin, that enslaving sin. Exodus 5 and verse 4. The king of Egypt said to Moses and Aaron, Moses and Aaron have come and made this request of Pharaoh, let my people go. And the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your labor. And Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor. So the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, you shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. And you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. You shall not reduce it, for they are idle, which is why they're crying out and saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let more work be laid on the men, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. We can take away from that the notion, the idea that when God favors you, when God starts to work with you, when he starts to bring you out of something, you can expect it to be tough. And here it got tougher. It got even worse for them, right? And they even come and complain to Moses and say, what are you doing to us? Because their officers are getting beaten and everything's getting worse and tough and hard for them. And he's got to tell them, you know, God's working here. This is happening. and he has to encourage them through it. But it's not uncommon for this to happen. When God begins to work with you, you think about somebody like Job. You go through and read the account of Job. It gets tough because sin is right there. And especially when Satan is right there and he sees God starting to come for you and work with you and try to redeem you, he's going to come after you. He's going to come after you hard. Let's continue on then. Exodus 7. Back to thinking about God's plan and God's preparation. The amount of effort that God put into what he was doing here. Exodus 7. Well, we see the account of the plagues. We see these 10 plagues that God had lined up. We see 3 plagues that were all across the land. We see 7 more plagues that only impacted the Egyptians and left the Israelites alone. But we see these 10 plagues occur. And if you read through this account and you start counting the number of days and the number of things that had to happen and the passage of time, most people's estimates put this period of plagues at least 40 or 50 days. The Hebrew Mishnah, or the Jewish Mishnah, puts it at 12 months, said that the 12 plagues, or the 10 plagues, took about 12 months, a full year. So it seems to be somewhere in that range, from the span of 40, 50 days to months of activity. And you think about all of the prep that God's putting into this, all of the effort that he's expending, right? And all of this carefully designed stuff that he's doing so that the Egyptians will see something, so that the Israelites will see something and come to learn and come to understand something about him. He's building up to something. He's preparing and he's putting a lot of himself into this. You can ask yourself, why? Why did he have to make such a big deal out of this? Why couldn't he have just sort of left the Egyptians alone and let them go? Because he could have, right? He could have worked it out so that it wasn't such a big deal. He didn't have to make such a big deal out of it just to get Israel out of the land. He could have done something and suddenly they're freed and off they go and everything's good, right? But he was demonstrating something here to them, to us, to the Egyptians. He was leading up and building up, as you see the intensity of these plagues builds up. He's leading up and demonstrating the magnitude of what he was about to do. This was a big deal. And he wasn't going to let it just sort of happen and go by. He was preparing and he was demonstrating and showing, look, get ready for something. Get ready for how big this is. That was just the physical type. When we're thinking about Israel and looking at the story of ancient Israel, and we recognize that there are parallels with the New Testament and parallels with what Jesus Christ did in his ministry, physically, we don't think of the story of Jesus Christ's ministry as being something as epic as the Exodus account, in the sense that there were no massive plagues destroying a nation. There was no Red Sea dividing and a whole nation passing through. But those things were actually the physical type, the smaller thing, demonstrating the magnitude of the spiritual thing, the bigger thing. God was showing and is showing both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament that this holy day that we are about to observe pictures something immense, right? In a very wonderful, positive way. It required some really tough things. But what it's leading up to and what it's picturing is incredible. And he's doing something both physically, we see in the Old Testament, and spiritually, we see in the New Testament. Something that he wants us to be preparing for, to be excited about. our preparations then, as we go about getting ready for this holy day season, they should reflect that. Part of what we're doing, we know, is this physical de-leavening. De-leavening points to something. It points to that removal of sin. It points to something that is really big, that's really incredible, that's really impossible physically, that's really just can't be done without all of the epic monumental things that happened preceding it. And he asks us to do something to prepare for it. He asks us to, you know, get ready for this. You should see what's going to happen. Let's look at the culmination of events over in Exodus 12. Jumping into the middle of the story, Exodus 12 and verse 5, he's commanding them regarding this lamb. So they're going to take a Passover lamb, as we've come to know it, but they're going to take a lamb, verse 5, without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. And they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. Verse 12. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. And this is exactly what happened. We can drop down to verse 29. Exodus 12:29. And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. For Israel, their freedom from slavery, right, their exit from Egypt required thousands of deaths, maybe tens of thousands of deaths. There were a lot of deaths that night. For us, there was one death. So we see that the Passover reminds us of the cost of deliverance from sin. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians. First Corinthians 11 and verse 28. So we see there's not just one set of preparation that we are commanded to do. There's a little bit more. We see this expanded. We see this extended. We see the physical type. We see this de-leavening that we're supposed to do. And then we see here in 1 Corinthians 11, we have an additional command. Let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. This is in advance to the Passover. This is a command that was given to those who are coming up on the Passover service, who are about to keep the Passover service. And he says, you need to examine yourself. Verse 29, for he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this reason, many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. For if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. He says you've got to be actively preparing, not just in a physical way, in a spiritual way too. We see multiple components of this. Right? This is also a unique command relating to his holy days. Should we be examining ourselves all the time? Yes, absolutely. Should we especially be doing so leading up to Passover? Yes, absolutely. Right? We don't see this command, this encouragement, explicitly in relation to any of his other holy days. This is fairly unique to Passover. He says, you need to be discerning, you need to be examining. And so just like de-leavening is unique, coming up to this holy day, from a physical sense, we have this examination command that's fairly unique coming up to the holy days as well. Are we doing that? Are we searching for sin? Are we asking to see it? That's not always a fun one. But are we asking to see it, to find it, to know about it, to be able to overcome it, to be able to put it out? You know, if we understand the cost of freedom, then that's something that we should really be compelled to do. We should really be driven. Are we giving these holy days the proper forethought, the proper attention that they deserve? Right? You can think about it. We've had a lot of sermons recently about the Sabbath in this similar sense, right? That we need to be prepared. It's not something where we just hit the end of 6 days and we hit pause on those 6 days, and now I'm into the Sabbath and I'm all about God and I'm focused, right? There are things that we need to be doing those other 6 days in preparation for that seventh day. We have a similar thing going here, where we have a certain amount of preparation leading up to this holy day that we get to keep. And we need to be putting the time and the attention into it. We need to be planning for it to make it meaningful. I've heard one of my previous pastors, he described the Days of Unleavened Bread as a time of breakthroughs for many people. And it can be so for us, but you don't just stumble into it. We don't just sort of haphazardly get to the Days of Unleavened Bread. You know, we'll go around and pull everything out the cupboards and throw them in a bag and out the door, sun goes down. We're good to go. You know, that's not what he's telling us to do. That's not the intent of the preparation. Preparation is to be something fuller, something more meaningful, something recognizing the full intent and the impact of these holy days. So we see the physical de-leavening is not it alone. We have this spiritual aspect of it. But interestingly, physical de-leavening is not for Passover. By the time we hit Passover, and those of us who are going to be here on Passover, when we're sitting in this room on Passover, right, there will be leavening possibly in our homes. Because by the time Passover hits, we are not de-leavened. We don't need to be de-leavened. It doesn't say that everything has to be out of your home by the time Passover starts. It says everything has to be out of your home by the time the Days of Unleavened Bread start. We've heard the thought that, you know, at midnight, when all of the firstborn died, right, they were essentially free. They were free to go. Pharaoh gave the command, you're free to go. But they were still there in Egypt. They were still surrounded by that type of sin. Passover enables the exit from sin. Jesus Christ's sacrifice enables us to begin the process of overcoming sin and walking out. But it doesn't make us that way. It doesn't get us there. It's the start. It's the very beginning. De-leavening, then, is a preparation not for that event, but for the 7 days that follow. for the 7 days that follow Passover, we want to be ready for that in that physical sense and have all of that type of sin put out of our homes. Why 7 days? Say, okay, this is interesting. Why do we have 7 days where we have no leavening and we eat unleavened bread and it's interesting, but why 7 days? We get to the end of that 7 days and most of us go out that evening and find something with a little bit of bread in it and we're back into eating bread. And that's not wrong. Right? God has no commands. Well, if you're really righteous, you'll do this for 8 days. But, you know, it's 7 days. He says, do this for 7 days. It's unlike most of the other holy days in that sense. Most of the other days are a single day. It's something here, it's something there. But we have two holy days that are 7 days long, the days of unleavened bread and the Feast of Tabernacles. And those days represent fullness, completeness. When you think about the number 7 in the Bible, it's fairly well documented that that represents fullness and completeness. You think about the 7 days of creation. You think about the count leading up to Pentecost. Right? Seven times 7 days, 7 weeks, right? And then on the 50th day, Pentecost. And even in Acts 2, it says, when the day of Pentecost was fully come, was there, right? And it was full, it was complete, the time was ready. God was going to give his Spirit. The year of Jubilee, similarly. Every 7 years, interestingly, slaves were set free. Every 7 times 7 years, when the fullness of that time had come, property rights went back to people, there was a big release, right? It was the fullness of time. We see there are 7 annual holy days. God's representing the fullness of his plan through these 7 holy days. The book of Revelation, we see it all over the place. There's 7 churches, 7 trumpets, 7 thunders, 7 plagues, 7 spirits. We see sevens everywhere representing, in that sense, the fullness of things. The 7 churches representing the fullness of the church, the totality of the church. He has messages for us that are relevant. So we see 7 picturing completeness, picturing fullness. And then we go back and we say, okay, well, we have 7 days of unleavened bread. What's that all about? Those 7 days represent the fullness, the completeness of your life. So what you're doing is you're symbolically, in the sense of de-leavening, you're preparing for a holy day that pictures your whole life's work of putting out sin. We're doing this for 7 days. We observe this feast for 7 days, knowing that after we have accepted Jesus Christ's sacrifice, after that, his blood has covered us, that the fullness of our life following that is for us to overcome sin, to put it out. It's not all done for you. It enables you to then begin working with God and to be able to actually start overcoming, to actually be forgiven for those things. So we have this feast that pictures that, this feast that pictures the fullness of what we're here to do, really of our life's work. So from that sense, we're preparing, not just physically, not just spiritually, right? If you can't have, it's really incomplete without both. Because the physical teaches us something, the spiritual teaches us something. From that sense, we're preparing with our whole being. Right? Everything that we can put into this, everything that we can do to prepare and be ready for this is what we're doing with our heart, soul, and strength. Because if you think about, well, okay, if you just do the physical prep and you neglect that spiritual prep, Paul tells us that there were people that were getting sick and dying among the church there because they neglected that spiritual preparation. If you just do the spiritual prep and not the physical prep, you're breaking the commandments that God has given you. Right? We're not following what he's told us to do. We're not following his instructions. And what we're actually doing is missing out on a whole bunch of things that we could be learning from that type, from that symbol. He has us do these physical things and walk through these physical motions to educate us because we're physical creatures. We learn things in that process. And so he has us do both of them. And we do everything we can, should be doing everything we can with all of our heart, soul, and strength so that we can be prepared for these holy days when they arrive. Let's take a look at Exodus 13. Because we can see what happened. We can see how Israel spent these 7 days that they observed. Exodus 13 and verse 21. Verse 20, we see that they took their journey and they camped at the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He was there in the pillar and of cloud and in the pillar of fire to guide them, to lead them for those 7 days. He led them to the Red Sea. In that same sense that we have these 7 days picturing our life where we should be led by God, by his Spirit. It should be active. That should be showing us where to be and where to go. Day and night. It was full. It was complete. He was there for them. We have that type for us that we can see, okay, this is what we do also. We follow. And that's our whole lives, again, that 7 days, picturing our all that we have left, all of the time that we have left. No giving up, right? No turning back and walking back the other direction, straying off into the wilderness. They spent 7 days following that cloud down to the Red Sea. Let's take a look at chapter 14. Chapter 14 and verse 21, we see them led to the Red Sea, this obstacle that they could not overcome, not on their own. This was not doable. It was not physically possible. Exodus 14 and verse 21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them in the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, again, that was there leading them. And he troubled the army of the Egyptians, and he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. And then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. This was that seventh day. This was the last day there of unleavened bread. And there, as that holy day started, that night they started walking into that sea. And by morning they came out the other side. And they're on the other side of the sea for the first time. Let's go back to think about those two types. Right? We had the type of leavening representing sin. We have Egypt representing sin. Here on the other side of the Red Sea, they are still with unleavened bread. Right? They've been traveling. They haven't had time to leaven their bread. It says they ate unleavened bread the whole trip, the whole 7 days they were moving. So here on the other side of the sea, they are without leavened bread. And they are out of Egypt, and Egypt is gone and done. So for the very first time, they were without both types of sin. Those were eliminated. And they said this was the first time. Never happened before. And so it is for us. Similarly, when we hit the end of that 7 days, when we hit the end of our life, and our life is complete, we will be without sin. If we've followed God, if we've followed His guidance, that pillar, right, and He's led us our whole lives, we get to the end of our life, we live out that fullness of our life doing that, and we are going to be, for the first time, free. Free of sin, completely. Which we can't do in this life. Not achievable in this life. But at the end of this, at the end of this whole experience, we can be, we will be. So we see it was two things, right? They needed to get out of sin. They needed to get sin away from them. Right? We have these similar sort of things that we face. We need to get out of sin, get out of sinful situations, get out of sinful mindsets, right? The things that we can be surrounded in, that we shouldn't be surrounded in. We also need to get sin out of us. Sin shouldn't be a part of us. And so we need it removed in both contexts. That's sort of what we're leading up to. That's what we're preparing for. We're preparing for a set of holy days that pictures that possibility, that we can do that, that we can actually overcome that. We'll close up here at Romans 6, if you'll turn over there. But you think about the gratification that comes from overcoming sin. If you've ever overcome a sin, even something small, where you can look back and say, I don't do that anymore. You know, this is something I prayed a lot about, and this is something that's passed and it's gone. And you think about the magnitude of even being able to overcome something small like that, right? It's incredible. And that's what these days picture. These days picture that process, the ability for us to be able to go to God, to have our sins covered, removed, right? To have Jesus Christ's blood applied to them and washed away. And our lifelong process of continuing in that, of continuing to put it out. You know, we spend 7 days making sure that we don't eat leavening. Sometimes we fail. But we spend our whole lives trying to do this also. And sometimes we fail. But the magnitude of what is pictured is that we can overcome it. And so God asks us to do a little bit of prep in advance for that. And He did quite a bit of prep as well. Romans 6 and verse 12. Well, before we get there, you think about D11A also from the sense that if you've ever talked to somebody and you've been able to talk about D11ing, you know, somebody I've talked to, religious people who will say, that's really neat. But we understand the spiritual meaning of that. And so the physical part of that, you know, that's not really relevant. That was a shadow of things to come. And so now here we are, and that's good. But we understand that we need to put sin out, and we don't need to do that anymore. But what we've just looked at, what we've gone through, we look at the magnitude of all this, and we look at the fact that God asks us to do maybe something a little bit rigorous, you know, some rigorous prep and removal and cleanup and investigation and self-examination and all these things that He wants us to do, physically and spiritually. It's all really just part of loving God with our heart, our soul, and our strength. With everything that we have. Romans 6. Verse 12. Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in its lusts. Do not present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin, but present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness to God. For sin shall not have dominion over you, for you are not under law, but under grace. We've gone through the idea of law and grace here recently. If you missed those sermons, I'd highly recommend that you go through them. But what he's saying here, it's the same principle, that you're not under this law of sin and death. These holy days picture the ability to be out of that cycle of you sin and you die. And which is why he tells us in verse 12, do not let sin reign in your mortal body. You take sin and you put it out of your physical house, your leavening. You get rid of that from your physical house. You take sin and you put it out of your spiritual house. You put it out of your body, your temple, right, that God is working to perfect. So let's go about preparing in that sense. Let's get the physical leavening out. Let's do the preparation. Let's learn those lessons. Let's get the sin out of our lives. Let's do the spiritual preparation and the self-examination. Let's prepare for these holy days with our whole being.